This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The View from 22 podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor of The Spectator. In this week's issue, political editor James Forsyth asks whether David Cameron is somehow beating the Eurosceptics against all odds. In the wake of the publication of the draft EU deal this week, James suggests that the current climate ought to have whipped up the perfect storm for Eurosceptics to pounce. Amidst the migrant crisis plaguing the continent and widespread dislike of the EU in Britain, those backing Brexit could not have dreamed of a better scenario. But instead, the Eurosceptic campaign is in chaos. Here to discuss this with James is Vote Leave's Stephen Parkinson. And just how was Donald Trump trumped? The Spectator's deputy editor Freddie Gray asks what went wrong in Iowa for the Donald and whether Trump's campaign will now melt away. Here to discuss that with Freddie about what's next for the grand old party is the Republican Party overseas representative Kate Andrews. And I'll also be talking to Stephen Bailey about the Spectator's inaugural What's That Thing award, given to the worst public art polluting our townscapes. After a year scouring the streets of Britain, he talks us through the worst offenders. And joining him to discuss why not all public art is something to be ashamed of is historic England's Posy Metz. Now, where did it go so wrong for the Brexit campaign? Eurosceptics could hardly have asked for more favourable conditions for a referendum, and the arguments for Britain leaving the EU are all there, waiting for someone persuasive to deliver them, says James Forsyth. But, James argues, after years of waiting, the painful truth is that Euroscepticism is not ready for the confrontation it has spent so long hoping for. James is joined now by Stephen Parkinson from Vote Leave to discuss whether Eurosceptics are too divided to seize the moment. So, Stephen Parkinson, is the Leave campaign really in the chaos that James describes it as?
No, it's not in chaos at all. I know that it's sort of in the Westminster bubble, people like to focus on sort of personalities and who's up and who's down and the mechanics of campaigns, but I can tell you, in January we had 150 street stalls up and down the country, in every part of the UK. We're delivering hundreds of thousands of leaflets, having conversations with people, signing up hundreds and thousands of new supporters every weekend. So it's actually going really rather well.
You're winning the ground for what you're saying, but the air war has involved quite a lot of people going on television, writing letters to one another, suggesting that things should be being done differently, that there should be different personnel involved in the Leave campaign.
Well, I think on the air war we're doing well as well. I mean, if you look at this week, the air war has been entirely about the Prime Minister's so-called deal with Donald Tusk, which he's going to be presenting to the public. I think it's very clear from this morning's papers and from the coverage that he's got just in the last 24 hours that people are seeing through that, and that's in part thanks to the arguments that the Leave campaigners are pointing out. We're poking out the holes in his arguments and exposing them so people can see that he's really missed the opportunity to bring about the fundamental change that he used to talk about delivering when we tried to reform our relationship with the EU.
So what's the problem then, James Forsyth?
I think the biggest challenge for OUT is to explain to voters what OUT looks like. It is quite clear the kind of campaign that David Cameron intends to run, talking about uncertainty, a kind of new version of Project Fear. And I think one of OUT's problems is that it seems that almost every Eurosceptic you ask has a slightly different version of what OUT means. Some people want to be inside the single market, some people want to be inside the customs union, some people just want to abide by WTO rules. I think this is one of the problems for Euroscepticism, which is that it hasn't kind of, in some ways, this is the beauty of it, which is Britain would become a fully independent and self-governing country again and can make its own decisions. But part of the problem in terms of dealing with a risk-averse electorate is you have to be able to clearly explain to them what OUT looks like. And I don't think at the moment the various OUT campaigns are succeeding
I don't think that's fair. Since we launched in October last year, we have been talking very explicitly about the sort of deal that we want to have, a friendly relationship with the rest of Europe based on trade and cooperation, just without the rows that we have at the moment about propping up the Eurozone and sort of squabbling over the latest directives. Those sorts of deals are perfectly possible. But we're not running to be the next government. The day after we vote leave, there will still be a majority Conservative government and politics will carry on. And that's when the government of the day gets into the, you know, negotiating the terms of exit and what we want. You know, we are just talking about bringing back control so that the UK government can make those decisions.
But there is a challenge for you that you know, I mean, the voter who says, but what does out look like? You can't tell them what the terms of exit are. And I think you almost, it's always not clear what you want the terms of exit to be. I mean, it's unclear to me whether free movement, for example, would continue under if we left the European Union or not. You know, I think this is one of the problems, which is that there is a slight lack of clarity at the moment on these questions.
We are very clear that the UK can get a very good deal outside of the European Union. No country of our size and importance has left the EU. And people like to sort of, you know, point to say, oh, look at Norway and the deal that they got. We're six times bigger. No. We could get a deal that is at least six times better than Norway's. But we can't sort of get into that now, because if you start having those discussions, then no end of Eurocrats are going to pop up and say, well, of course, that's completely impossible, because they are campaigning wholeheartedly along with the Prime Minister to keep us in. They'll say it's impossible until we voted leave and focus their minds on getting the sort of deal that we really need.
And this is one of the problems that you've got, isn't it, that David Cameron is now campaigning for his renegotiation, but ministers who want to vote to leave the EU can't say anything. Do you think that collective responsibility should now be suspended that David Cameron has set out basically his position, which is to remain?
Yeah, I thought yesterday's speech in a factory in Chippenham looked and felt like a general election event. And I think Jeremy Corbyn had made a very good point that if you are purporting to bring powers back to the UK Parliament, then the polite thing to do, indeed the logical thing to do in your argument, would be to come and talk to the UK Parliament rather than go and make a sort of general election stump speech to the media. So if the Prime Minister is going to be out there on the campaign trail so wholeheartedly, then people on the other side of the argument should be free to do the same as well. And, you know, we're picking up more and more members of Parliament who are happy to say, well, having looked at that deal, it's not for me and I'm going to be campaigning to leave. But this is, you know, this is about more than just politicians and from across the political parties.
But you are, as James says in his piece, missing the big beast at the moment, aren't you, politically?
This is not going to be a campaign that has one single figurehead. I mean, to get 51% of the vote, which is what you need to win, there is no single political figure in the UK that on his or her own can command that. And actually, this is not just about politicians. It's about business leaders. It's about people from all sorts of walks of life.
But if you want to balance the beasts, most of the beasts at the moment, including your former boss, Theresa May, seem to be going on to the Remain side.
Yeah, well, you know, I think we'll see after the February Council on the 18th, once it's clear what the deal is and when we know that there's a referendum. I think quite a lot of people are holding back because there's a sort of phony war period at the moment. Once they know when the referendum date actually is, I mean, if you're the chairman or chief executive of a big company, or if you're a cabinet minister or a prominent person from any other walk of life, you know, signing up to what could still be a referendum that doesn't come until the end of 2017 is a bit of a tall order. But once people know that we're into the campaign, then I think you'll see a lot more people coming forward and making arguments about why we'd be better off outside the EU.
One of the worries for the out campaign has got to be that traditionally in referendum campaigns that the change proposition needs to be ahead before the campaign starts. But in this referendum campaign, it's actually Cameron who is getting almost the kind of clear air to make his argument at the moment, which is, you know, I thought it was remarkable in the, just come from the Commons where there's been the statement. You've got the leader of the Labour Party, you've got the Prime Minister. They're all making the same argument, essentially. I mean, there is a challenge here for out about kind of getting cut through without a big political or national figure. You know, I think one of the oddities of this is these arguments are there to be made. You know, first of all, it is clearly not as good a deal as the 2013 Bloomberg speech indicated that Cameron won. There are clearly holes in it. There are also huge areas of the EU, like the common fisheries policy or common agricultural policy or EU regional policy, that haven't been touched at all by this deal. It's not that the arguments aren't there, but is there a kind of megaphone to amplify them to the public to cut through?
Yeah, we don't underestimate the scale of the task. I mean, as you see, if you've signed up to our emails, we say constantly we know that we are going to be campaigning against the full force of the establishment, the machinery of Whitehall, the machinery of Brussels, Downing Street ringing round FTSE 100 companies to try and get them out and support, the big corporations that'll bankroll. Set against that are the sort of millions of people up and down the country who just want to take back control from the EU and have the sort of control over over our laws that would solve the problems that they confront in their daily lives. And that's what we're building up. It's been really quite moving to see how keen people are to volunteer. And while the BSE campaign have been paying to deliver their leaflets, we've had no end of supporters and volunteers coming forward and offering to run street stalls and to deliver and to knock on doors for us and to campaign.
Would it be even easier for you if you were the one Leave campaign? There are now three Leave campaigns. And are you hoping to merge with Leave EU and the Grassroots Out group, or do you think you can't really work together and you won't appeal to voters?
There will be just one campaign. When the referendum comes, the Electoral Commission will designate and pick one official Leave campaign, and then everybody that wants to get out of the EU will come together and work for that outcome. In the meantime, it's not actually that unhelpful to have a range of voices out there making the different arguments. As I say, we need to win 51% of the vote. That's not something that any one political party can achieve on their own. So to get 51%, you need to fire up the base, energise the core vote, but you've also got to speak to the swing voters that get you over the halfway mark. That's very much what we're focusing on with Vote Leave, the people who are undecided, who will wait to see what the deal says and who then want to sort of weigh up the pros and cons of leaving.
That was James Forsyth and Vote Leave's Stephen Parkinson on the crisis in Euroscepticism. And next up, The Spectator's Freddie Gray talks us through whether Donald Trump's balmy rebellion is on the verge of collapse following his defeat in Iowa. The billionaire businessman's supporters now appear to be considering their options and deciding who to back in the race for the Republican Party nomination. But will they turn to Ted Cruz as the anti-Washington candidate, or hop onto the Marco Rubio bandwagon? Or might they still stick with the Donald after all? Joining Freddie is Kate Andrews from the Republican Party overseas. So Freddie, what went wrong for Donald in Iowa?
Well, I think he's proved that organised politics actually matters, and that campaigning in a conventional sense, trying to get the vote out, canvassing, actually works.
And he didn't do that.
He didn't really do that, no. But I think what is actually still staggering is that he came so close to winning without abiding by any of the conventional rules of campaigning.
Kate Andrews, do you think that he could have won had he done the grassroots work that his opponents had?
Yes, I think he absolutely could have. He's relied far too much on the national media and talking to CNN and talking to Fox News, whereas Senator Ted Cruz was out actually knocking on doors and going to picnics and going to, local games, local football games, local soccer games. And that's how you win over votes, especially in a place like Iowa, where they had a record turnout this year for the Republican caucus that was only 180,000 people. In 2012, it was 120,000 people. A few thousand votes can dictate that election. You have to go put in the groundwork.
Were you surprised by the result?
I was nervous about the results. I wasn't actually completely surprised by Senator Ted Cruz's win. Him and Donald Trump have been going back and forth in the polls. Donald Trump was ahead going into this caucus, but Ted Cruz, the fact that he emerged wasn't particularly surprising. The real knockout performance was Senator Marco Rubio. He's been branded the establishment candidate, and in a state which is very socially conservative, which is very upset with the establishment, the fact that he came within one percentage point of Donald Trump is incredible and really gives his campaign a boost.
Freddie, on this podcast before, we've talked about the fact that Rubio's campaign is always about to hit momentum but never does. Has it now got momentum?
I think it has now. I think actually Rubio benefited from the vicious attack ads of Jeb Bush's campaign, which actually sort of made him feel anti-establishment, even though he's not.
What sort of things were they saying?
Just another Washington politician is the line. Rubio is very unpopular for having flip-flopped on immigration. And I think that he's he's now he's emerged as a sort of anti-Washington force, but I mean, how long he can keep up that charade is very, very dubious.
I agree with you, Freddie. I think that he has been labeled an establishment candidate, and Jeb Bush helped him to not look that way. But I also think he's been unfairly branded in that way. Marco Rubio is the most anti-establishment candidate of the establishment. Even if you just look at his history, if you look at his parents, if you look from the fact that he doesn't come from wealth, he really built up his home life, and he's still not wealthy. He's not one of the Washington insiders. He's not a part of this very rich elite that people keep claiming are buying elections. So I think it was his bipartisan effort to reform immigration, and it is a shame he flip-flopped on that, because he actually came up with some great provisions, but he knows in this particular election, mostly thanks to Donald Trump, if he doesn't take a very hard line on immigration, especially in the primaries, it will hurt him.
Do you think now, though, candidates might have a little bit more confidence now that Trump has been knocked back a little bit to be themselves a bit more, Kate?
I hope so. Marco Rubio has been producing some really funny, really great videos for a while now, trying to show that personality side to him. One of the biggest criticisms of Senator Ted Cruz is that he is lacking in that personality. There's a lot of talk, a lot of whispers about the fact that he's not liked within Washington. He doesn't have a lot of endorsements, especially from not even just the establishment, but just other Republicans, generally speaking. So we will see those personalities emerge. I think we'll really see them emerge when other candidates drop out. The stage is too big right now for us to actually get to know these candidates personally.
Are you expecting candidates to drop out quite soon, Freddie?
Well, I think there'll be a lot of pressure on Bush and Kasich, and well, maybe Kasich after New Hampshire, and Chris Christie to drop out now. And obviously you'd expect Rubio to mop up a lot of their support. But, I mean, going back to Cruz, yes, his personality is pretty unpleasant. I don't know if anyone's seen the video of him trying to kiss his daughter. It's pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But I think that he's underrated at the peril of the rest of the Republican establishment, because he's much better funded than previous evangelical candidates who've won Iowa, like Huckabee or Santorum. And in fact, the counter-establishment, the anger within the Republican Party is much stronger than it's ever been, which is what the Trump phenomenon proved.
That's a really good point. And I definitely would not rule Cruz out whatsoever. He does have that money. He does have that momentum that previous candidates didn't have. And also, he's now emerged as an alternative anti-establishment vote. So we all thought that was going to be Donald Trump. We all thought he was the one that was going to bring votes away from Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. Actually, it's turned out that Ted Cruz is a viable alternative. So when we go into South Carolina, and especially when we get to Super Tuesday on March 1st, you have Texas voting, you have the Deep South voting, they might not turn to Donald Trump, they might turn to Senator Ted Cruz, and if he brings them along with his established base already, then he could be looking at a high percentage of the vote.
Now, Freddie, what does Donald Trump do now to try and rescue his campaign?
Well, there's a theory that he's going to go rogue and declare himself as an independent candidate.
His tweets have certainly suggested some roguish behaviour.
Yeah, well, I think he's so angry at this idea that Cruz stole the Iowa election, the Iowa caucuses by sort of dirty tricks. But he might be setting himself up there to say the Republican establishment is corrupt and here I'm going to make my glorious run by myself. Or he may just never really have been that serious. I mean, that's actually something you've got to consider. I think he got so swept up in his own momentum. But I think now, I mean, just judging from his sort of performance on Monday night itself, he doesn't really look like he minds that much.
There's a theory, isn't there, that he may actually have entered this contest as a bit of a joke, and it's been,
yeah, or to promote his TV show,
and is thinking desperately, how do I get out of this?
Yeah, it's the great mystery of Trump. I mean, is he this unbelievable genius who seems to be winging it, or is he actually just winging it?
Kate, is he a genius or is he winging it?
Well, he's very talented, especially when it comes to media and entertainment. I don't think anybody could take that away from him. But no, I don't think he did do this as a joke. There was also speculation that the Clintons got him to do this to help Hillary in the end. Donald Trump claims he had a conversation with Bill Clinton the week before.
A lot of Cruz fans believe that.
Yes. There's, you know, true speculation there, not something I'm promoting. But, you know, this isn't the first time that Donald Trump has dabbled in politics. I think it was the Reform Party that he joined a while back, saying he was going to run for president. Clearly, it's something he's always thought of as like maybe a fun side project. But I think realistically, Donald Trump does not run as an independent. For him, this is only fun if he's winning. And if he's not winning, and if he were to get, say, even even generously 15% of the vote in a general election, he has no interest in spending his money on that or spending his time on that unless he thinks he's going to win.
It's a very good point. He's always been more into the showbiz of politics than the politics. I mean, it's interesting he always talks about his ratings, not his polls, because I think he thinks in terms of TV viewing ratings.
Mm-hmm. And he loves the attention and he loves the fun and he loves sticking it to the other candidates and making fun of their hair as his ratings rise, precisely. But, you know, his tweets today were very strange. They were aggressive. He was accusing other candidates of things that maybe they have or have not done. But you were saying, Freddie, he's actually had to delete some of those tweets.
Yes. Because isn't it amazing that Donald Trump has deleted
it? Yes, it's just
even
truly shocking. This is breaking news. This is breaking news. I mean, he's not reacting well to his loss, and I think he has imploded a bit. He handled himself graciously on late Monday evening in America when he admitted that he had been beat, but it's really starting to implode now.
That was Freddie Gray and Kate Andrews asking what's next for the Republican Party. And finally, The Spectator has announced the winner of its first ever What's That Thing award for the worst piece of public art in Britain. The award went to Dashi Namdakov's She Guardian sculpture on Park Lane, described by Stephen Bailey as a fusion of Fungus the Bogeyman and Dungeons and Dragons. Other monuments in Oxford, North Lanarkshire and in London also picked up prizes. But what makes a piece of public art bad? And what helps a good piece of art stand out from the crowd? Posy Metz from Historic England, who decides which sculptures are worthy of protection, joins Stephen.
So Stephen Bailey, what are the worst public sculptures that you've seen? You detail them in your piece, but just give readers an idea.
Well, there are so many. I think one of the most depressing aspects of contemporary life, and don't misunderstand, I'm enthused by contemporary life. One of the most depressing things in contemporary life is the travesty of the idea of public art, which we have to tolerate nowadays. I mean, there are so many examples of awfulness, but I think outstanding has been recently a piece in Park Lane by a Russian artist called Dashi Namdakov, which doesn't get beyond sort of Dragons and Dungeons war games type symbolism, Fungus the Bogeyman. It's just all fangs and muscles, and it's inappropriate to London. It would be inappropriate in his native Mongolia, but it just sits there as an offence. You know, instead of, you know, what one's expectations of public art, something which might add a certain element of beauty, provoke a little bit of thoughtfulness on behalf of the public, this just causes offence.
What's your favourite piece of public art?
Well, I think, you know, for me, the whole idea of public art is itself questionable, because I think what's nowadays called public art doesn't really have an active concept of what the public is, and even if it did, that public is now fragmented and not a coherent body, and nor does it actually, you know, reach a credible standard of what I would call art. There are certain tests, I believe, for art, and most so-called public art doesn't reach them. But I think, interestingly, I don't think you can actually create public art nowadays. Although, no, some people make a good effort at it. I mean, Richard Serra in Broadgate in the City of London by Liverpool Street, that's one very rare example of outstanding public art, I believe. But I think that so much of what's going on with public art nowadays is just a sort of feeble repetition of an idea which is now redundant. You know, it's an obsolete concept. And I think we can see this. If you look at Historic England's latest exhibition at Somerset House, the one called Out There, looking at public art of the 40s, 50s and 60s, and I think it even goes up to the 70s. Yeah, that was the last moment, I believe, when the idea of public art had some credibility and utility. And you can see that. There's some of the great stuff by Moore and Hepworth and various old Bauhaus artists who found their way to
England. So the golden era of public art is over.
It's gone. Well,
do you agree with that, Posy Metz?
It's quite a difficult question to answer, actually, because certainly when we at Historic England were looking at art that might be worthy of listing, we're looking at pieces that are really 30 years old or older. So we're seeing them with the benefit of time, that perspective that time gives us. And actually, I think it's a very interesting question as to the art that's being produced now. What will we be listing of it in the future? Will there be pieces? I'm sure there will be. But we do need that test of time to be proven. So it's going to be a while before we can start to really, I think, answer that question seriously.
And what sort of criteria would you use to assess really durable public art that captures people's imagination, but it is also something that can be critically appreciated as well?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. when we're assessing for listing, obviously artistic merit is a key factor, but actually listing is really about more than that. It's about identifying pieces that, when seen within their historic context, have an importance that goes beyond just themselves as pieces of artwork. So, for example, I mean, one of the pieces that was listed is by Anthony Gormley. Now, obviously, Gormley is seen as one of our current most important artists. But the piece that we selected was particularly important because it was one of his first commissions. So it has a level of interest that goes just beyond its artistic interest. It marks the start of Gormley's career. And that's obviously one of the more recent pieces in terms of date that we've listed. But other examples, they represent particular themes, particular ideas that were happening at that time, the idea of post-war reconstruction, and particularly critical period. And one piece, for example, is actually a memorial to prisoners of war. And a very unusual example in this country to have that sort of a memorial. And it was designed and made by somebody who was themselves a prisoner of war. So it goes beyond just the aesthetic interest of that piece.
Stephen Bailey, I suppose going beyond the aesthetic interest of the piece is something that also can be a problem. You say in your piece that if you walk alongside developments of luxury apartments on the south bank of the Thames, you can find hideous public art as well. Is that because the developers are thinking we must put some public art here and it will look nice, and they're not particularly bothered about the quality of it?
Well, yes, I think I fear that's all too often the case. I mean, I think what Historic England does, I should emphasise, is superb, and I wouldn't take any exception to what was just said. But I think there's a great difference between the sort of archival antiquarian responsibilities which Historic England has to safeguard great art of the past, great buildings of the past. Wonderful, I'm all for that. So a great difference between that and trying to assess whether, you know, contemporary art has any aesthetic, you know, value. It's quite a different thing. I think you almost accepted that it's not necessarily the same thing. For personally, I don't want to personalise or do any ad hominem comment. I don't particularly sympathise with your views about Gormley, who I think is at best a lightweight. But yeah, I mean, he has significance because of his media profile and the rest of it. I just think that what happens nowadays? There were great moments when public art meant something. 16th century Florence, Victorian Britain, and superlative monument. The years of the post-war settlement, which is discussed in the Historic England exhibition. These were moments when it was credible. There was utility there. But nowadays, I mean, what actually happens? There's this sort of infernal cabal of so-called artists who are replicating an idea of what they think an artist used to be, in the pay of developers who've hired this dreadful tribe of for hire curators and art consultants who just deal in this utterly inward-looking world of how to plonk something into a development to get past the Section 106 of the 1990 Town and Country Planning Act, which gives developers a break if they have a planning gain by putting some art in the property.
But would that art really last if it's not particularly good? Is it not just a sort of transient piece that's going to disappear after a few
years? Well, that's fine.
Ones are the ones that Historic England approach.
That's fine. I'm all for the processes of history grinding through dross and separating. The whole purpose here, more the Spectator's What's That Thing Award for, is it's not to chastise artists or patrons, and it's certainly not to thwart creativity or beauty or imagination. We know we're all for those things. What we're trying to do is just get a talking point, an argument, really, about what's mediocre and what's excellent. And it's my very firm view that almost all recent public art has been mediocre or worse.
And Posey, I have to say that most of the time when I read about public art in the news, it's when it's been stolen. Is that becoming an increasing problem?
It is a problem. It's interesting. I don't know whether it's an increasing problem or it's just always been a bit of a problem. I mean, I think the problems with, the rise in the value of scrap metal and that sort of thing has unfortunately,
well,
had an impact.
Well, yes, we do have to admit, theft is a very good criterion of quality in anything. I always think anytime you go to an art gallery or a shop, the best test is, do you want to steal something? And then it's great. But, yes, as you just said, most of the Hepworths and Moors, which have been nicked recently, have been nicked to be smelted and turned into ingots. There's a really good test. I mean, public art, if it means anything, and I'm sceptical whether it does, should be about beauty. And there's a very, very, very good test for beauty. And, something is beautiful if when you see it, you want more of it.
Is that right, Rosie?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that test applies to a lot of the things that we were looking at. One of, in particular, there's a piece by Naam Garbo, Revolving Torsion, at St Thomas Hospital. And Garbo is obviously a very key 20th century artist, but he had a great belief in art in public spaces. He believed that that's where art should be, that it should be everywhere, that people are going about their daily lives. But actually, very, very few pieces of his work are in the public domain. I think there's Revolving Torsion, there's a piece in Rotterdam. Those are the only ones we could identify. And it's a shame, because actually I love his work, and it would be wonderful to see more of it outside and in the open air, where I think he would have liked a lot of it to have been seen.
I'll tell you something really interesting we found in running the Spectator What's That Thing award, is that the critics, no matter what perspective they come from, the judges, almost never disagree. Quality always sings out.
That was Stephen Bailey and Posy Metz on Public Art, Good and Bad. And you can see a gallery of the worst offenders in Stephen's view on the Spectator website. Thank you for listening to this week's edition of The View from 22. To listen to more of our podcasts, visit our website at www.spectator.co.uk/podcast. Alternatively, to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, search under podcasts for The Spectator. And podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22.
Gary, Winston Wolf, Direct Line. Your landlord Mike says you wrecked this place.
Wait,
knocking holes in the walls. And all that graffiti? Fancy yourself an artiste?
No.
But it's all covered, Gary. Mike is with Direct Line. They'll cover up to the full amount insured for malicious damage by tenants.
Oh, good. Can I go now?
Oh, no, Gary. Direct Line's looking after Mike, but who's looking after you?
Direct Line Landlord Insurance covers up to the sum insured for malicious damage by tenants. Can your landlord insurance do that? Search Direct Line Landlord. Optional extra qualifying criteria and excess apply, underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.